nickel on the sides. So nickel will act as a mirror if the neutrons come in at a grazing angle. So it helps to keep the neutrons in there. But that guy is big. It's about this big. And we take out a little piece of it, but it's still big. And of course, the reason is that even though we have a big reactor, there aren't many neutrons. So there's even less neutrons at the wavelength we're interested in. And I wanted to spend a little bit of time saying how that beam affects the experiment. But the first piece of that I want to do is to go back and look at the wave properties of the neutron. So you know that the neutron is a particle, but of course its dynamics are dictated by wave mechanics. And I wanted to return to this very simple experiment where we put two prisms there. And I draw the prisms like this, but they're really 90 degrees from that. I want to raise the beam in this direction. Okay. And so if we look at what happens, well, okay, we create equals superposition. With the first blade. And then we write a phase here. And this phase has a few pieces to it. Of course, it has one piece because the path length becomes a little bit longer when I shift through those prisms. It turns out that phase shift, it's easy to calculate. If you really want to see it, you can see it, but it's not very important. And just so I don't drag things around, I'm not going to include it. There's, of course, a phase shift because you're going through the prisms. So just like there'd be a phase shift with this phase flap, the prisms are made of the same material, but that phase shift is boring. Now I'm just going to put it into the phase flap, right? It's just going to add to it. We actually tend to have a set of prisms in this path as well that are closed on each other, just to make sure things don't get too far out of hand. But then the piece that we want is that there's a phase shift, as we talked about, due to the shifting of the plane wave of the neutron interferometer. And so if we keep this shift, so KZ is of course describing the momentum, and the momentum obviously in Z direction. And if I come down here and I look at the zero path, then we have an output
So then we have the coherent superposition, and of course it's a coherent superposition of displaced and not displaced beams. And so let me go back here and say, oh, that I want to add to this piece a second qubit, and so we have a qubit which is the displacement and a qubit which is the path. Okay, and so coming out of the zero path where I've traced over the path degree of freedom, then I only need to keep the displacement qubit, and I have a coherent superposition of the neutron in a path and displaced from that path. Good. All right. So now it's useful to look at the intensity of this. And I want to look at the intensity as a function of delta z. So then we have the intensity is equal to keep doing this. I should be more careful here. That's delta z. And this, of course, is delta z. Right? That the phase we pick up is a difference because we've shifted over on the wave function. Okay. So now here we have this piece. And we need to remind ourselves that kz is described by a classical distribution over that. And that, of course, although the neutron is going to be in many different places, that's not what's giving us this distribution. It's the distribution of momentum. We're assuming that the neutron has the same momentum regardless of where it sits. And now I need to spend a couple seconds describing how we get our neutron into our experiment. So we have a reactor over here. We have our guide. There's a moderator. You know, reactors are born who are hot, right? So we need to moderate them. And so I can describe the probability versus the momentum. And this would be the momentum in the x direction. And it'll look like that. And we're going to put a crystal here. And it'll select out a little piece of this. And so we'll have our diffraction. And then we're going to take this, and we're going to take it to set of 7 crystals. And each of these are going to be focused on the monochrome, on the interferometer. So we have what's called a focusing monochromator. And the reason we do that is because we don't have any neutrons. And so I want to focus the beam down so that I have 7 times 0 instead of 0 neutrons. And so we get this piece that comes. And this is correctly shown, that this is the z direction. And I showed you the direction of the blades. And so to a first order, the z direction doesn't matter to that, okay? And the correct dimensions are that this is 10 centimeters, and this distance is about 7 meters. Okay, so now then we can say, well, okay, I can take...
What's the distance from the focusing crystal to the
side of the neutron? So the focusing crystal, this is about 2 meters. Might be a little bit longer than that. The crystal is in this vibrationally isolated space that's also temperature controlled, and this is outside on the guide floor hole.
Right.
So it's
salt.
And what kind of angle, I guess, what kind of angle is that beam made? Like, what's the...
Sure.
Okay.
So now then we can say, oh, well, what does this look like? So if I put in our probability, it looks like a half minus the integral P of KZ. Cosine of theta plus kz delta z dz. And we can see that nicely we have the cosine part of the Fourier transform of our momentum distribution. So to answer your question, what I need to do is to go and say, fine, let me take and make a set of measurements as a function of delta z, and then Fourier transform it. Yeah.
Sorry. I had a question about the expression you wrote. Mm-hmm. So you integrated out the momentum kz of the cosine part of your expression. Does it mean that the momentum gives that intensity like different amplitudes?
Because think about it here. That because I have each of these crystals, each crystal obviously has a different momentum in the z direction. But of course, there'll be some width to them as well. And so the probability distribution is a distribution that a neutron that we detect, right, because we're post-selected, came by one of those paths. And so the first thing we do is just show you the contrast as a function of the separation in angstroms of those two blades. And so this is actually a very direct measure of the coherence length along that direction. So we've taken our wave packets, and as we separate the wave packets in the two beams, once the wave packets are outside their coherence length, there'll be no interference. And so you can see the difference here is how many of these blades. And so one thing we can do is we can say, okay, I'm going to block the blades, and I'll just leave the middle blade. And of course, if I just leave the middle blade, then the momentum distribution is at its longest, and we get the top curve, and you can see that the coherence length is something like 500 angstroms. Whereas if I simply take all of them, which is the lowest one, then we see that, as you would expect, you have my computer turning off. You have the system falling off fast. But of course, this is not a Gaussian result. We have those, they're really separate blades. And so if I take the Fourier transform of that data, then I get this result showing this is for one blade, of course, for five, and for, in this case, nine blades. And you can see that it looks very much like I've added the distribution for each of those nine blades. Okay? And we very directly can measure the spread of momentum. Okay, so now that we know a little bit about how we should think about this, we say, oh, I've got this beam, it's spread out. The particle is going to randomly appear at some location, but wherever it appears, it'll have a momentum spread on average given by what our optics are over that. And it also says that if we wanted to say to get to the narrowest momentum spread, that this spread of a few thousandths in momentum is as small as our experiment would allow. And that piece is coming primarily from this crystal, okay, which is the hottest crystal in the system because it sees the most neutrons. It's just a graphite, a piece of graphite. Okay, good. Now, oh yeah. It's also worthwhile noting that I could have recovered something like this by post-selecting on a momentum. So I could have put a crystal here that would do another diffraction and put my detector after it, right? It really is an incoherent distribution of momenta. You can get very high resolution from Bragg scattering. So I can get 10 to minus 5 if I'm careful about the whole system. So it's a question of what you're scattering off of and how you've selected it. And if you go to, there's a couple ways of doing this. The way that works at reactors is you have a fairly intense beam and you select it in momentum and then use that momentum selection. The way it works in the spallation sources is you have an accelerator that generates neutrons. You don't have a reactor. And so then you have a pulse source. And you lock into that pulse to, in a Fourier sense, select your momentum. And then you can try to use a little bit of the best of both worlds and say, oh, I'm going to take, and I'll spend a moment later on to show you this. I'm going to take the magnetic dependence. So if the spin is precessing in a magnetic field, then the angle of its precession is a record of what its momentum is. So I can use that record to accept a wider range of neutrons into my sample, but still to select out for the energy afterwards. And if you look at small angle neutron scattering experiments, they're often done with the so-called spin echo approach. They also, of course, can have energy resolving and position resolving detectors, right? They tend to be huge. But we'll keep this piece. Now, this gives us a little piece of it, right? This says, well, what's the coherence length along the z direction? Yeah.
You may have been mentioning this, but I was wondering if there's like a rule for knowing when I should think about a displacement with respect to the size of the beam as another qubit just for the vertical direction, or when I should expect it to like recombine with the other beam enough that I don't think that as another qubit.
It's a good question. You know, you say, let's take this beam, and now I have it separated, and I want to treat that as a qubit. If I want to treat it as a qubit, it's nice that the separation be large. So I'd like it to be outside of the coherence length. But, the only rules are apply Schrodinger's equation and crank. But I can put a crystal here and I can diffract. Pretend I drew that correctly. So that I recombine the two beams. And then I look here, of course. And so even though they were outside the coherence length, then I've brought them back together and I'll see the coherence recovered. So we can add, you know, another little interferometer, right? To our existing interferometer to recover that data. Okay. Now this piece says that we've got the coherence length in Z. Yeah.
Fine enough that assembly were diffracting more of them?
No.
Then how are you getting both from the same level?
So the diffraction.
So I diffract, just like you drew over there, in fact. I diffracted the one path into the same angle. So because the two paths are both diffracted into the same plane, into the same beam, then they recombine. Yeah, it takes a little while to see that. So there's two other degrees of freedom that we would like to know the coherence length over. The first is in time. And you can put bismuth here, which doesn't absorb neutrons, but has a big index of refraction. So it slows them down. So by the amount of bismuth you place here, you can take your wave packets and you can displace them in time. And doing this, we can measure the momentum spread along the direction. And of course, the momentum in that direction is really finely determined. The momentum in the z direction is of course determined. So this length is very, very long. Okay, it's a drag to get a good measurement, but it's millimeters anyways. And we can take the experiment and run it just as I actually did draw it there, of saying let's put our prisms now, but put them really in that direction so that we displace the beam in that direction and we can measure the coherence length. The way this experiment is actually done usually, though it's much more of a drag than this, is to machine a crystal where you move this blade in. So you intentionally put it at the wrong place. But that's just too much work for me. Why machine a crystal when I can move a prism? And this, of course, also, you've selected that momentum so well that the coherence length is really quite large. Okay. Good. I'm going to come back to an application of this, but before I do, I want to go and think about this distributed beam. So I'm going to place a prism in the z direction in my beam. I just draw it like I've always been drawing it, but it's in z. And so now then, we'll have a phase which is going to be Q times Z. So I want a phase that depends upon the height of the beam, the height of the neutron in the beam. And over here, these prisms are really quite thick because the index of refraction is really small. It's 10 to the minus 5. But this prism is really quite thin because remember that 40 microns gives us a 2 pi rotation. And so if I'm writing a wave number, right, so this is 2 pi per unit length, and it corresponds to that given whatever the I'm varying the silica with. So this becomes a very, very thin prism. Okay. The good news is it's so thin that I don't have to worry about the change in momentum of it. So I'm going to treat it just as though it's writing a spatial phase over the sample. And of course, now then, if I look here, well, if I look there, of course, I'm going to see this phase. I'll add a phase flag. And so it'd be very much like the above, right? That I would say, oh, I see the probability of a neutron at height z cosine of phase plus q of z, and I would integrate over z. Right, and so this says now the probability that there is a neutron at height z. And of course, the intensity as a function of q is equal to 1/2 plus 1/2 that. But I'm never interested in that first piece, right? I'm only interested in the contrast part of this. Now, this again is going to give us a Fourier transform of the shape of the beam. And so I can measure the shape of beam, so we'll get the Fourier transform of the beam shape. And if I looked at the detector, if I looked at the beam over here, instead of using a helium-3 detector, if I used a detector that was a plane, that was an area detector, it was a mapping detector, then I would see this grating. The separation would be 2 pi over q. And of course, these two would be complementary, right? The application for this comes from the realization that, of course, if I put the same prism here, I would refocus that, right? I wouldn't see any effect. So instead of putting the same prism, I put the sample here, which has a phase as a function of z. And I take the probability that the neutrons are there, I take this to be 1, so that I can introduce just that phase. And now then, I end up with the Fourier transform of that phase. And so we can measure, in this case, an image of the system. Now, you might ask me, well, if I have this position-sensitive detector, why am I fooling around to measure this with a helium-3 detector and then take the Fourier transform? And the reason is that in a position-sensitive detector, you start off by having a thin scintillator. So the scintillator converts neutrons to light. And then following that, you have a CCD detector. And because when you convert neutrons or any scintillator, you convert any charged particle, any particle, to light, it acts as a point source. So you have this challenge that we'd like the scintillator to be thick so that there's a high probability that I've stopped a neutron and I've detected something. But I need the scintillator to be thin so that this point source doesn't lead to a blurring of the image. The further away I put it, the more blurred the image. And there's an additional feature that, in fact, I can't put the CCD behind the scintillator directly for neutrons, because the neutrons are going to go through the scintillator and they'll damage the CCD. So your camera wouldn't last very long. And so we have to replace the CCD with some optics, which isn't so hard to do, but you still have to do it. So these two-dimensional detectors are nice to look at, but since they're so inefficient at collecting neutrons, we would never use them in a robust experiment. So what we would do instead is to replace these with helium-3 detectors, measure in the reciprocal space by varying this prism, and nicely you can vary a prism by having two prisms and rotating them relative to each other. And so you can see all of that. So now you can say, oh yes, I can do one-dimensional imaging as an application of my neutron interferometer. And fortunately, we can see inside materials. And neutrons are nice things for imaging because they look at light particles. So, and of course, they penetrate metals very well. So this the most elaborate application of neutron imaging is to look at hydrogen embrittlement in aluminum in airplanes. And there's an airfield in San Diego where underneath the airfield there's a reactor, and then there's a reflector to shoot neutrons up through the runway. And they park a plane there, and they can image the hydrogen embrittlement of the skins, of the aluminum skins on airplanes. And you may have seen it's a hazard of flying in the Hawaiian Islands that the skin of the plane will peel off. That the there are lots of airlines, of course, in Hawaiian Islands because it's an easy way to get around. But they don't make a lot of money, so they buy old planes. And they have lots of flights. The flights are short. So they're hopping between, and every time they fly, it stresses the skin, and you have salt water. And so the combination of lots of flights, salt water, and old planes means that occasionally the rivets fail, and the skin of the airline will peel off in flight. And somehow it very rarely causes real disasters, except I wouldn't want to be sitting there. And you can use neutron imaging to follow that. Of course, if they don't have the price to replace their planes, they probably don't have the price for neutron imaging. But the Defense Department does. Yeah, that's right. Well, you know, it's a drag to put a nuclear reactor at every airport. Okay, so then we've got one dimension. We need to have two dimensions, and it's relatively simple. If you if I look at a two-dimensional object, and I take the two-dimensional Fourier transform. So kx and ky, and so there's some relate to distribution. There's a trivial to prove theorem called the central slice theorem. That says, if I take a ray in the reciprocal space description, and I take the inverse Fourier transform of this. So this was 2D. This is, of course, 1D, because I'm just Fourier transforming that ray. Then that ray corresponds to the projection of the data at the same angle. And so you can build up your data and recover the two-dimensional image. Okay. Good. The last piece I want to show with this part before getting back to displacement is to go back to our neutron interferometer, the original one. Now remember that we had we saw that in the experiment, if this is counts, and that's zero, and this is the total, that the experimental data of our best result looks sort of like this. And that what we said was that there was an effect due to this blade not being a 90 degree pulse. So but that would leave us always coming up to 1 and 0. And that there was an effect due to random phases in the system. And you already showed that if you had random phases, imperfections on the crystal, at those two blades, they wouldn't matter. And I'll remind you of the number again, 40 microns per 2 pi. So when we machine these, we try to machine them very well. But up until recently, we haven't been able to do it perfectly. We hope that we can do it now. But these two don't matter. But of course, we have the imperfections on the other sides. It's easy to see that if the imperfections are always a sigma z operator, that those two better add. And of course, these two better add. And because this is a perfect pi rotation, these add again. And of course, you might say, well, a pi rotation looks like I've flipped by 180 degrees, so they should subtract. But of course, it's a random event. And so they're just the addition of Gaussians. And so all we're doing is taking a Gaussian distribution for this noise and making it broader and broader and broader. And if we measured it on one blade, then it should end up being four times as broad. No, twice as broad. Four examples, twice as broad. Good. Okay. And so if I go back to this thing, Okay, I thought I had done that right. So if you look at lecture 3, which will come up in a second. Good. First, to show you, if I have a helium-3 detector, what I would expect to see as a function of the phase and Q. Now I've just put one prism in the interferometer. And of course, as the pitch of that prism becomes large, we lose all contrast. Not surprising. This is what the data actually looks like. And so you can see that it actually does look like a Fourier transform of a top hat function. And I didn't go over and show you, but clearly we can get the sine and cosine separately because we have the two beams, one coming with positive and the other with a negative difference in a phase. And so we see the two sync functions. We can show for the position sensitive detector what the contrast looks like. And of course, as a function of Q, and as you'd expect in the two beams, it is complementary. All of that you don't need. But here, so here I've just made a contrast curve which allows us to change the transmission probability of the first and third blade and the noise. And the noise is just modeled as a Gaussian. And so if the noise is zero, then with the transmission probability, you see, as I promised, that we never go away from the 0 and 1 points. If I add noise, we do. And let's maybe, let's see. If I can, somehow I think that that's not quite right. I think that that's about where the data was. The data is in lecture 1, and I won't go and pull it up. But you can see the parameters, the noise, of course, we would like to be 0, and the transmission, we would like it to be pi/2. Okay. I want to show you one more application today. So we saw that a neutron interferometer, if we set two prisms and I have a phase flag, that out of here I get a spatial separation of the beam. And now I want to think about what the phase looks like in a material. So let's look at a plot of the difference in phase over delta z for delta z. So the expectation value of the difference in phase. And so we're imagining that we're putting a sample here. And of course, we have a distribution of these displaced beams. So at every location, there's a set of displaced beams. And afterwards, I can recombine them and look. And so this difference in phase over the two paths is an observable. And typically for a material, it starts off with the difference in those two phases being 0. Okay. And then it's going to increase, and it'll do something. And eventually, on average, it goes to zero again. And here, this piece is, the difference is zero because the sample looks the same as you translationally displace it. So imagine, for instance, that you were a biochemist. I know it's shocking, but you would model your protein as saying some random packed sets of spheres. But you know, as you displace it, until you get out of the sphere, it's going to look pretty much like it was. And then, you know, there's a funny piece that says once you've displaced it, well, just from the random packing, you're going to see the interstitial space between those. And then eventually, as you displace it further, everything is random. And so you won't see any features at all. And so this piece says that the phase is constant with delta z. And therefore, of course, you're going to have contrast, right? So here we have contrast. This piece says that the phase to the interstitial space, however you spell it, is different. So here you're still going to have contrast. The contrast will be reduced, but there'll be this small distribution. And now here, it says the phase is random. And so there's no contrast. And this is by far the main use of neutron optics. And what we would like to do is to be able to push this length scale to larger and larger dimensions. You'd like to be able to scan over a large sample. You'd like to be able to scan over a large separation. And if I rely upon this with small angle neutron scattering, then we can get up to some angstroms. If we use the interferometer method, we can get up to hundreds of angstroms. And if we changed the axis about which we were looking, we could go much, much higher. We could go to millimeters, maybe even. The challenge is that this setup has many, many, many fewer neutrons than the small angle neutron scattering. So the small angle neutron scattering has a dynamic range of 10 to the 5. And we have a dynamic range of 10 to the 2. And so we need to still find a clever way of increasing the number of neutrons that go through our interferometer by three orders of magnitude. And there's ways of doing that, but I won't talk about them today. Okay? Okay, so I'm going to stop here because I want to ask you a little bit about your homework. And then we'll...